Chapter 7. Antibiotics. It has been suggested that antibiotics have been responsible for a 10-year increase in lifespan because of their ability to limit premature death through bacterial infection. This is compared to a 2-year increase in lifespan if all cancers were curable. So where did they come from? A few antimicrobials have been used by some indigenous populations for centuries. Quinine, from the bark of the cinchona tree, had been used by the Quechua people of Peru. It was effective against malaria, and this knowledge was brought back to Europe by the Spanish in the 17th century, when it became possible to control malaria. However, there are more than 100 prescription medicines that are derived from the plants of the rainforest, and some have antibacterial properties. As the indigenous populations became adept at exploiting these plants, they were able to control some bacterial infections. In 1843, Oliver Wendell Holmes concluded that puerperal fever, contracted by women during childbirth, came from person-to-person contact, probably from the physicians treating them. However, he did not realise that bacteria were the cause. He also noted that some physicians had died after performing autopsies on infected patients. Holmes suggested that physicians performing these autopsies should sterilise their surgical instruments and their clothing should be burnt. His most drastic conclusion was that the physician should not participate in cases involving childbirth for the following 6 months. Ignaz Semmelweis, a Hungarian doctor working in Vienna in 1847, had a less drastic solution. He noticed that the incidence of puerperal fever was much lower in wards where the doctors washed their hands after they had performed these autopsies. He insisted that all doctors performing autopsies should wash their hands in dilute calcium hypochlorite, which reduced the cases of puerperal fever by 90%. This is probably the first documented use of chemicals to control infection, albeit not on the patients themselves. Florence Nightingale was sent to Scutari in 1854 during the Crimean War. At the time, soldiers were 10 times more likely to die from severe bacterial infections, including dysentery and cholera, than on the battlefield. She realised that the patients were infecting each other and campaigned for better sanitary conditions within hospitals, recommending changes in hospital design to reduce cross-infection. Improvements in hygiene, which prevent infection, are known as asepsis. Only 7 years later, the American Civil War changed warfare. In this first mechanised war, the casualties were far greater and more severe than in previous combats. The extent of injuries attracted infection, which often resulted in amputation. George Titchener, a Confederate doctor, experimented with the use of alcohol on wounds. In 1863, he was wounded himself in the leg and insisted that his leg was treated with alcohol rather than amputated. His wound healed, and he successfully treated many soldiers' battle injuries. This was the first use of chemicals to control infection on the patient, and Titchener went on after the war to patent his alcohol antiseptic. In 1865, Joseph Lister, a surgeon from Glasgow, noticed that there were fewer infections in births administered by midwives than by surgeons, and he attributed this to poor hand-washing by the latter. Surgeons were instructed to wear gloves during all surgery and to wash their hands in carbolic acid, a phenol-based solution. Lister also found that spraying swabs with carbolic acid considerably reduced the incidence of gangrene and other infections. This is considered to be the start of concerted antisepsis, the control of infections with chemicals. These chemicals were extremely effective, but they were not sufficiently selective to be administered inside the body and could only be used against infections on the body's surface. At the end of the 19th century, bacterial infections were the primary cause of premature death. The high incidence of diseases such as syphilis and tuberculosis drove the search for chemicals that could selectively cure a bacterial infection. Louis Pasteur proposed the germ theory of infection and the role of bacteria. He noticed that some gastrointestinal infections improved in patients who had eaten blue cheese. The blue streaks were caused by Penicillium notatum, and the bacillus causing anthrax would not grow if it had first been contaminated with some airborne moulds. Although Pasteur recognised that this might have therapeutic value, he considered that vaccines were the only efficient method to control infection. By the turn of the 20th century, bacteria were recognised as the cause of many infections. Paul Ehrlich knew that some dyes were able to stain bacteria while leaving other cells unstained. He argued that this showed that some chemicals bind specifically to bacteria but not to human cells, and therefore could be administered internally to the patient as the basis of a chemical-based therapy that selectively killed bacteria. He was the first to describe this concept as a magic bullet, and he started a search for such a compound. He chemically altered nitrogenous dyes, little by little, and he tested each variant against suitable bacteria. The 606th compound he tested was arsphenamine in 1909, and 1 year later it was marketed by Hoechst AG as Salvarsan for the treatment of syphilis. Arsphenamine is an arsenic-based compound, but it was only partially selective. Its severe side effects sometimes led to death. Modification of the molecule to give the more soluble neo-salvarsan reduced the side effects, and it remained the primary treatment for syphilis for the next 35 years. Military casualties in the First World War were on an unprecedented scale. Witnessing them had a profound effect on a German medical orderly and a British doctor, Gerhard Domag and Alexander Fleming. The high mortality from infections in wounds, rather than battle casualties, motivated them to identify chemicals which could be used systemically to combat bacterial infection. After the war, Domag studied medicine and Fleming experimented with lysozyme, an enzyme that attacks the cell wall of bacteria, in an attempt to use it as an antibacterial drug. Although effective on bacteria in petri dishes, lysozyme is a large protein which would not survive in the body, excluding it for systemic use. During his experiments, Fleming made the iconic serendipitous observation that colonies of Staphylococcus aureus on nutrient agar in a petri dish were killed if there was a specific fungus also growing on the agar. The fungus was Penicillium notatum, and Fleming realised that the fungus released a small molecular weight compound as it could travel so far through the relatively viscous agar to kill the bacteria. He named this unknown compound penicillin. Fleming purified the Penicillium notatum and repeated his initial observation, but this time substituting other pathogenic bacteria. It was able to kill almost all gram-positive bacteria, but did not have a significant effect on gram-negative bacteria. He prepared large cultures of Penicillium notatum, removed the fungus, and kept the broth. It was an active antibacterial agent. Even when it was diluted, he found it had significant inhibitory properties. He did not succeed in purifying the compound, and it proved to be unstable. He published his findings in 1929, but they were then ignored for 10 years. The destruction of one organism by another had already been designated as antibiosis by Paul Wimer in 1889, so Fleming called penicillin an antibiotic. While working for IG Farbenindustrie, now Bayer AG, Gerhard Domag thought that Ehrlich's tests were not sufficiently rigorous, so he examined the effects of compounds manufactured by IG Farbenindustrie on mice infected with streptococcus. He argued that an antibacterial compound need only prevent bacteria growing, and the body defences would do the rest. In 1932, Domag tested a red dye, later called Prontosil, on mice. All those treated with Prontosil survived infection with streptococcus, whereas untreated mice died. Like Fleming, Domag found that Prontosil was active against gram-positive bacteria, but not against gram-negative. However, it was absorbed when taken orally, and it was readily excreted through the kidneys, which meant that it did not accumulate. Prontosil was tested for 2 years in patients with infections caused by gram-positive bacteria, with remarkable results, curing previously fatal illnesses. The Pasteur Institute in Paris found that the active component of Prontosil was sulfanilamide, a sulfonamide. So pure sulfanilamide was substituted as therapy, and a search was made for other sulfonamides which were able to inhibit bacteria that were unaffected by sulfanilamide, in particular for a sulfonamide that would cure tuberculosis. Domag's research slowed with the outbreak of war, and despite opposition from army surgeons, he was able to demonstrate that sulfonamides were crucial in preventing gangrene in soldiers wounded in battle. In contrast, the war stimulated interest in antibacterials amongst the Allies. In the late 1930s, at the University of Oxford, Ernst Chain read Fleming's 1929 paper on penicillin, and, with his boss Howard Florey, he cultured Penicillium notatum, a sample of which had been given to the university some years before. They found penicillin was hard to purify, and incorrectly assuming it was an enzyme, they freeze-dried it. This stabilised the penicillin, as well as concentrating it to a product 1 million times more active than Fleming's extract. In 1941, after extensive animal experiments, they tried the purified penicillin on a policeman dying of septicemia caused by Staphylococcus aureus. He was treated every 3 hours with penicillin, his temperature dropped, and he improved until the supply of penicillin was exhausted, when he worsened and eventually died. Clinical trials were continued once sufficient quantities had been produced, and miraculous cures were achieved. Laboratories in the USA were recruited into production, manufacturing large quantities in the last year or so of the war. Many Allied soldiers will have owed their lives to penicillin, but it was still only effective against gram-positive bacteria, and many of the wounds had been infected by gram-negative bacteria, especially if they had become contaminated with soil. There was no cure for these, and often penicillin eradicated the gram-positive bacteria only to allow gram-negative infections to take over. The discovery of penicillin stimulated many microbiologists to search for new antibiotic-producing organisms, particularly from the soil. Selman Waksman at Rutgers University in New Jersey devised a technique to look for organisms that had antibacterial properties. He prepared soil samples with their live bacteria and placed them in a petri dish. He then placed an agar suspension on top of them, containing pathogenic gram-negative bacteria. He found that one soil bacterium in particular, the gram-positive Streptomyces levenduli, was very effective at inhibiting the growth of the pathogenic bacteria. The antibacterial chemical it produced, streptothricin, when purified, was found to be soluble in water and stable. It was also active against many gram-negative bacteria, as well as gram-positive bacteria. By discovering the genus Streptomyces, Waksman had identified the source of what was going to produce 2/3 of all our antibiotics. Streptothricin was too toxic for human use, so Waksman and colleagues examined a large number of Streptomyces species. Many produced antibacterials, and the yield could be improved by altering the nutrients on which they grew. All the antibacterials were toxic, until, in 1943, they found 2 strains that produced an antibacterial in much larger quantities than they had seen before. This antibacterial was highly effective against most gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria, and was capable of curing systemic infections in animals without apparent toxic effects. They named the antibacterial streptomycin. The control of gram-negative infections by streptomycin was as important an antibiotic discovery as penicillin. Waksman's colleague, Albert Schatz, tested streptomycin against Mycobacterium tuberculosis and found that it also was inhibited. Streptomycin was not too toxic in animals infected with tuberculosis, and it eradicated the infection even if they had been close to death. Pulmonary tuberculosis was first cured in a woman treated empirically in the USA over a 6-month period in 1944. The reason why these 3 compounds, penicillin, sulfonamides, and streptomycin, were selectively toxic to bacteria without harming the human cells was unknown. Bacteria from the Streptomyces genus were soon isolated all over the world, and literally hundreds of antibacterial compounds were found. However, only a few were not toxic to humans, including chloramphenicol, tetracycline and vancomycin, all antibiotics that we still use today. Other antibacterials soon followed. Amphotericin, cycloserin, erythromycin, gentamicin, kanamycin, lincomycin, neomycin, nystatin, rifampicin and spectinomycin. Many of these also from the bacteria of the Streptomyces genus. A fungus had produced penicillin, so other fungi were tested, but they were not nearly as prolific as Streptomyces. In 1945, Giuseppe Brozzu noticed the incidence of typhoid fever, prevalent in Italy at the time, was lower in his city of Cagliari in Sardinia than elsewhere. There was a raw sewage outlet, but still those bathing near it did not get infected. Brozzu isolated a fungus, then called Cephalosporium acrimonium, which clearly produced a substance that killed gram-negative bacteria. Unable to analyse it further, he sent the strains to the group at the University of Oxford, who found it produced a myriad of antibiotics they called cephalosporins. One in particular, cephalosporin C, was suitable as a therapeutic agent. Bacteria and fungi were not providing antibiotics for our benefit, but rather for their own survival. These antibiotics, often called secondary metabolites, are not required for the growth of the organism, but rather to promote its survival in specific environments. The soil is a rich ecosystem of competing bacteria and fungi, with a finite supply of nutrients. In order to thrive, many microorganisms have to inhibit the growth of the opposing bacteria and fungi. Many evolved metabolic pathways that produce compounds toxic to competing bacteria, and then export them into their surroundings to ensure that their territory is free of challengers. Thus, it is not surprising that the vast majority of these compounds are toxic not just to other microorganisms, but also to us. By the start of the 1950s, most of the antibiotics derived from these soil organisms had been discovered. There were still bacteria that were not easily treated by these antibiotics, and many could only be given by injection because they could not survive the hydrochloric acid in the stomach. In production, the yield had been increased by selecting certain strains of antibiotic-producing microorganisms and by altering the conditions of fermentation, particularly changing the nutrient source. Selective chemical modification of the antibiotics produced by fermentation could improve not only the penetration of the drug, but also the spectrum. Fleming's original penicillin molecule was modified with the addition of an amine group, which not only prevented the molecule being destroyed by the stomach acid, allowing oral administration, but also increased the spectrum so that it could now attack gram-negative bacteria as well as gram-positive. The antibiotic created was ampicillin, which became the most widely used antibiotic in the world. The group of antibiotics that have undergone the most chemical modification are the cephalosporins, more than 50 different chemical modifications having been made, starting with the original molecules identified in Oxford. This has made them the most versatile group of antibiotics, which can be tailored to deal with almost all bacterial pathogens. Chemical modification still relied on fermentation to produce a natural product. Surely it would be easier to devise a chemical from basic principles and engineer it to inhibit specific pathogens, but this has proved to be an elusive goal. In the late 1940s, George Hitchings of Burroughs Wellcome was working on chemicals that he thought could inhibit the bacterial enzyme dihydrofolate reductase. He modified parts of his core molecule and found one, pyrimethamine, that was effective against malaria. Encouraged by this success, he made further modifications and found another that was selective particularly against gram-negative bacteria. This he called trimethoprim, which was put into clinical use in the 1960s. This was possibly the only case where a scientist actually engineered a completely new compound to inhibit bacteria, for which, like Fleming, Chain, Flory, Domark and Waxman before him, he earned a Nobel Prize. The other major group of chemical antibacterials has been the quinolones and naphthyridines. The first, nalidixic acid, was discovered in the early 1960s by George Lesher from his work on chloroquine production. A relatively ineffective antibacterial, the activity of this group of compounds could be radically improved if a fluorine atom was placed at position 4 of one of the aromatic rings. Many derivatives were synthesized and marketed, though the most successful was ciprofloxacin. The source of natural antibiotics ran out more than 60 years ago, and we have since relied on chemical modifications of these natural products, or the few chemical antibacterials, such as trimethoprim and ciprofloxacin, ever since. However, the options for introducing new modifications to current compounds are virtually exhausted. Pharmaceutical companies have, until recently, tried to devise new methods to discover antibiotics. One was to use high-throughput screening, where they would examine almost all the chemicals ever produced to see whether any had any useful antibacterial activity. This was not a directed approach and was largely unsuccessful. Advances in molecular biology meant that the DNA of complete bacterial genomes could be compared with the information from the Human Genome Project to identify targets in bacteria that did not exist in mammalian cells, thus allowing the possibility of devising a compound that would selectively inhibit the bacterium. A computer would screen the DNA sequences and highlight likely candidates. This approach also failed, and while it has been estimated that there are probably just over 100 possible targets in bacteria which do not exist in human cells, none of them could successfully be inhibited by chemicals. A further approach was to use the computer to model molecules using 3D spatial information on the likely target, usually an enzyme, so that virtual chemical modifications could be added to a compound to improve its binding. This approach has also failed, which has meant that we now face the immediate future with the antibiotics that we currently have, or very close analogues. The difficulty in designing a new antibiotic is essentially twofold. The compelling reason to discover new antibiotics is because bacteria have become resistant to the ones we have, and some of them are very resilient. Therefore, more powerful chemicals are needed to control them. The conundrum is that more powerful antibiotics are more likely to be active against human cells as well as bacteria. This becomes more acute as national regulatory authorities are continuously upgrading the safety requirements of their pharmaceuticals. It is estimated that many of the original antibiotics, if they were presented today as new pharmaceuticals, would not pass the safety regulations. The fluoroquinolone trovafloxacin was removed from clinical use in 1999 because it had been associated with the deaths of 14 patients who had suffered liver failure. At the time, about 300,000 prescriptions for trovafloxacin were being given each month in the USA. About 10% of the population has an allergy to penicillin and should avoid its use. However, in the USA, up to 400 people a year die from anaphylaxis following penicillin use, but there is no suggestion that penicillin should be removed from clinical use. A significant barrier to discovery and eventual clinical launch of new antibiotics is the safety requirements to which new antibiotics have to adhere. This is understandable when considering the use of antibiotics for simple community-acquired infections, but is a little surprising when the treatment of life-threatening infections, particularly in hospitals, is considered, and few viable antibiotics remain. It may be that a different risk-benefit analysis may need to be applied for the use of more toxic antibacterial drugs in the treatment of severe bacterial infections. There are many cases which will prove fatal if not treated, but might be resolved with antibiotics that do not pass current safety regulations. Selective toxicity. This leads to the question of how antibiotics work in the first place. Their essential characteristic is that they should be selective. The degree of selectivity has initially been quantified in a rather gruesome analysis of measuring the dose required to prevent the infection developing and the dose required to kill the animal, usually a group of mice that have been infected. This is called the therapeutic index, or ratio. it has been modified in humans as the ratio of the concentration of drug leading to toxicity of the drug divided by the minimum curative dose. As the ratio rises, the antibiotic is more selective. This measure of selective toxicity can identify how much antibiotic can be given and the likely success. The most toxic have ratios of 8, whereas the least toxic have ratios of 100 or more. Although the actions of the two earliest antibacterial drugs, sulfonamides and penicillin, were not known at the time of their clinical launch, they were subsequently found to be selective because they inhibited enzymes that only exist in bacteria, dihydroteroate synthetase and transpeptidase, respectively. Therefore, in theory, unlimited amounts of these drugs could be given, as they should have no target to bind to in human cells. This is not the case. Both drugs have been associated with severe adverse reactions, anaphylaxis for penicillin and Stevens-Johnson syndrome for sulfonamides. However, the ability to target a metabolic pathway that only exists in bacteria is an attractive basis for antibiotic use. The inhibition of transpeptidase by penicillins and cephalosporins is at the final stage of the synthesis of the bacterial cell wall, a structure composed of subunits that are almost unique to bacteria, including sugars such as N-acetylmuramic acid and the D-amino acids, for only L-amino acids are found in most mammalian cells. Other antibiotics were found to inhibit the pathways leading to the synthesis of the cell wall, notably vancomycin, the basis of frontline treatment of MRSA. Binding primarily to the D-amino acids of the cell wall, vancomycin is only partially selective, as it can be associated with adverse effects. The metabolic area where most antibiotics act is the inhibition of the manufacture of proteins. Although the basics of protein synthesis are the same in human and bacterial cells, the biological machinery is different. In both, protein synthesis occurs on the ribosomes, twin subunit molecules comprising both proteins and RNA. But bacteria and human cells have different compositions of these proteins, and some antibiotics exploit this. These antibiotics, such as streptomycin and chloramphenicol, bind only to the bacterial ribosomes and not to those in human cells, thus selectively inhibiting bacterial growth. Some, such as tetracycline, can inhibit both bacterial and mammalian protein synthesis, but are actively transported into bacterial cells and are thus excluded from mammalian cells. In this way, they are selective. If the concentration of any protein synthesis inhibiting antibiotic is sufficiently high, it will start to prevent protein synthesis in the mammalian cells. So the therapeutic index is important for this type of antibiotic. There are also antibacterials that inhibit bacterial folic acid synthesis, DNA and RNA synthesis, preferentially inhibiting the bacterial enzymes. Although the targets of the main antibiotics are known, it is not always clear how they actually work. All bacterial cells have a rigid cell wall, and this controls the osmotic pressure within the cell, which is generally high. Most of the cell wall synthesis inhibitors, but not all, leave the bacterial cell with an inadequate barrier to protect it against its environment, and thus their action leads to the death of the cells. Antibiotics such as these are called bactericidal antibiotics. The DNA and folic acid synthesis inhibitors either directly or indirectly lead to incorrect synthesis of new DNA, causing the cell to die, and so they are also bactericidal. On the other hand, the inhibitors of protein synthesis for the most part merely stop the bacterium from growing. These are known as bacteriostatic antibiotics. It could be argued that the better of these two types of antibiotic must be those that kill the bacteria. However, it was found early on that infections responded equally well to both bactericidal and bacteriostatic antibiotics. The rationale behind this is that the main role of an antibiotic is to prevent further multiplication of the bacteria causing the infection, thus limiting the bacterial load, which would surely increase without the administration of the drug. Once the progress of bacteria has been halted, the immune system could take over and deal with what had effectively become a static system. This model does work well for infections in patients with an efficient immune system, and early antibiotic therapy assumed that the patient would finally eradicate the bacteria. Since the 1960s, changes in medical and surgical practice have required greater capability from antibiotics. Transplantation of organs requires the administration of immunosuppressive drugs to combat rejection. Similarly, the use of certain cancer chemotherapeutic agents reduces the white blood cell count, known as neutropenia, lowering the ability to combat bacterial infection. These patients are administered antibiotics, often aggressively, to limit the onset of infection. However, treatment with an antibiotic merely stopping the bacterium dividing can become inadequate, as there is no capacity to mop up remaining cells, and infections can persist. Thus, for these types of patient, an antibiotic which can kill the bacteria would be preferable to one that merely stops the bacteria from dividing. Indeed, almost all the antibiotics used in this situation are bactericidal and kill bacteria quickly. Another advantage is that a bacteriostatic antibiotic would allow large numbers of bacteria to remain and might promote the emergence of resistance. Killing the bacteria reduces this risk, as dead bacteria cannot become resistant to antibiotics. There can be disadvantages to killing the bacterium, especially if the cell wall is broken in the process. Toxins may be released, either within the cell or those which form part of the cell wall, endotoxins, into the bloodstream, which may lead to septic shock. This is particularly apparent with gram-negative bacteria. The ability of an antibiotic to lyse the cell, colistin, or produce an inadequate cell wall, penicillin, is an obvious cause of cell death. However, these are the exceptions. There are four main groups of bactericidal antibiotics. The beta-lactams, such as penicillins and cephalosporins, the fluoroquinolones, such as ciprofloxacin, the diaminopyrimidines, such as trimethoprim, and aminoglycosides, such as streptomycin, inhibit a different step of bacterial metabolism, but they all kill bacteria in approximately the same way. When the antibiotic acts on the bacteria, protein synthesis must take place. If it is prevented, then the antibiotics do not kill. The proteins produced by the action of each group of antibiotics are often very similar. A combination of shock proteins that were originally identified when bacteria were exposed to extremes of temperature. These proteins encourage a survival response, which causes the death of the majority of bacterial cells, releasing vital metabolites needed to rescue the surviving cells. A small proportion of cells in most bacterial populations are metabolically inert at any one time, and thus do not produce these proteins. These are likely to be the potential survivors. In other words, the antibiotics elicit a response encouraging the majority of bacteria to kill themselves. If the concentration of antibiotic is sufficiently high, then there may be no survivors. But sometimes survivors persist, and they are able to proliferate again once the antibiotic has been removed. Quorum sensing. It has been known for some time that bacteria within a colony of cells are able to communicate with each other. This is known as quorum sensing. The ability to do this depends on the number and concentration of bacteria present. Some bacterial cells within the colony produce signalling molecules. These are N-acyl homoserine lactones in gram-negative bacteria and often oligopeptides in gram-positive bacteria. Other bacterial cells in the colony have receptors which detect these molecules. The binding of these signalling molecules at the receptor induces the activation of certain genes. The larger the number of bacterial cells, the more signalling molecules are able to bind to the receptors and the greater gene activation. If the cell concentration is too low, the binding of the signalling molecules is insufficient to trigger the gene activation. Furthermore, once the concentration of signalling molecules reaches a threshold, it induces even more of its own production. Many bacteria not only have the ability to communicate, but with an indication of their numbers, can initiate different collective responses. These responses can control many collective bacterial functions, such as cell division. We are not yet fully aware of all the bacterial functions affected by quorum sensing, but the response to antibiotics may be one of them. As stated earlier, not all bacteria in a colony are equally destroyed during antibiotic challenge, and the lack of protein synthesis may be the factor. If quorum sensing can control the stages of cell division, it will also be able to control whether certain proteins may be manufactured, and so the population of bacteria may control its response to the antibiotic. There is much evidence to show that the success of an antibiotic is dependent on the concentration of bacteria challenged. The more bacteria present, the less effective the antibiotic. Biofilms. The requirement for protein synthesis also saves bacteria in another situation. Many bacteria, including some pathogens important in human infection, can form biofilms. They are considered by some as the most widespread state in which many bacteria can exist. Although biofilm formation happens regularly on surfaces in nature, a common manifestation of a biofilm is the formation of dental plaque on teeth. Biofilms become serious when they occur on inert devices, such as plastic tubes, which are often inserted in extremely ill patients. In the formation of a biofilm, the first bacteria that encounter the inert aqueous surface attach to it, probably through appendages known as fimbriae or pili. This binding strengthens and becomes irreversible by the secretion of a slimy substance. This forms a complex mix of attachment sites to which other bacteria can bind. The cells are probably able to communicate by quorum sensing. The biofilm matures to form layers of non-dividing cells. The biofilm is covered by more actively dividing planktonic cells. The formation of biofilm has advantages in that the bacteria, in close proximity, have a heightened ability to communicate, and they can release planktonic cells to colonize other environments. It is, however, their response to antibiotics that is of most concern. Bacterial cells in biofilms have a vastly increased capability to overcome the effects of antibiotics, perhaps decreasing their susceptibility 1,000-fold. Two factors work against the antibiotic. The first is that biofilms are a mass of bacteria through which the antibiotic finds it difficult to penetrate. The second is that the inert environment and lack of appropriate protein synthesis ensure that the bacteria survive for longer. Spectrum of activity. Some early antibiotics had a narrow spectrum of activity, but with the advent of the broad-spectrum antibiotic streptomycin, almost all bacteria could be controlled. This raises the issue of which antibiotic is better, broad or narrow spectrum. It is an extremely difficult question to answer. A broad-spectrum antibiotic will almost certainly start inhibiting not just the pathogenic bacteria, but most non-pathogenic bacteria. This can have mild adverse effects, such as diarrhea, or the more serious attack on the microbiota, resulting in eradication of much of the gut flora and superinfection, with Clostridium difficile causing antibiotic-associated pseudomembranous colitis. This can become life-threatening, and is the reason why administration of the broad-spectrum cephalosporins is now often restricted. Therefore, administration of a broad-spectrum antibiotic can cause complications in areas of the body distant from the site of infection. Conversely, the administration of a narrow-spectrum antibiotic may be as detrimental for the opposite reason. There have been cases where narrow-spectrum antibiotics have been used to treat chest infections caused by the gram-negative bacterium Haemophilus influenzae. Although excellent for the eradication of gram-negative bacteria, they were without effect on gram-positive bacteria. Streptococcus pneumoniae, a gram-positive bacterium commonly causing pneumonia, can be an underlying infection kept in check, in part, by the less pathogenic Haemophilus influenzae. Eradication of the latter, however, can suddenly provide a bacterium-free environment in a vulnerable patient with active selection for the new pathogen. The essence of good prescribing is to provide an antibiotic with a sufficiently broad spectrum to deter any other bacteria entering the cleared site of infection without eradicating large numbers of bacteria in other parts of the body. Oral or injectable antibiotics. The site of administration of the antibiotic has an influence on this. There is a preference in the United Kingdom and North America for the oral administration of antibiotics, whereas elsewhere in the world, antibiotics are given, through choice, by injection. The latter does allow more rapid accumulation of the antibiotic at the site of infection, as it is quickly taken by the bloodstream. On the other hand, oral antibiotics have to pass through the stomach acid and become absorbed in the small intestine. This is a circuitous route and dependent on the efficiency of absorption, which is surprisingly poor for some antibiotics. This can result in much of the available antibiotic passing straight through the gastrointestinal tract, killing many of the resident harmless bacteria and providing an environment for the selection of resistant strains. Why antibiotics may fail? Antibiotics fail to cure an infection because we are trying to treat bacteria in a biofilm, or the causative organism has become resistant. There are other fundamental reasons as well. The delivery of an antibiotic to the site of infection ultimately depends on the bloodstream, from which the antibiotic will diffuse out of the capillaries. Many infections, including wounds, are often surrounded with an almost impenetrable layer of pus and other discarded products of the immune system. These are difficult matrices through which the antibiotic must pass in sufficient concentration to eradicate the infection. In these cases, cleaning or debridement of the wound is at least as effective as antibiotic treatment, and success is often not achievable without it.